Mrs. Whiting said, when Miles sat down opposite her in the gazebo. In asking this question, the old woman managed to convey, as with all such queries, that she was not anticipating a response that would enlighten her. Whereas some people's attitudes suggested that perhaps they knew something you didn't, Mrs. Whiting's implied that she knew everything you didn't. She alone had been paying attention, so it was her duty to bring you at least partially up to speed. She was elegantly dressed, especially for the backyard. If Cindy was already beginning to look dowdy, Mrs. Whiting herself, her hair cut and styled expertly, her tweed jacket and moleskin slacks smartly tailored, her wrists alive with jewelry, not scar tissue, looked like a woman who'd been enough of a good sport to give old age a try, but then decided against it, much preferring youth. Somehow she'd negotiated for its return. Not all at once, of course, but rather gradually, a minute, an hour, a day at a time, the clock hands ticking backward until, presumably, she arrived at a satisfactory vantage. Even spookier, Mrs. Whiting also radiated, Miles had no idea how, a sexuality that was alive and ticking. Something about her knowing smile hinted that she'd gotten laid more recently than Miles had, and that she knew it. As if she might even have considered him, briefly, as a sexual partner, then rejected the notion. At the moment, she had positioned herself in a patch of weakening September sun, leaving Miles the chilly chair in the shade. Taking note of the arrangement, he couldn't help recalling his brother's observation that, far from dying, Mrs. Whiting was living, while those around her were relegated to a kind of limbo. With his back to the river, Miles's view was of the sloping lawn and gravel path, bordered in white brick, that wound its way up to the house. Had she wished to, Mrs. Whiting might have widened the path, perhaps even paved it, so her crippled daughter would also have access to the gazebo. After all, it was the nicest architectural feature of the property, especially on a sunny afternoon, although today he thought he caught a whiff of something rancid in the air. "I suspect that's occurred to anyone who's ever seen a river, Mrs. Whiting," he said. After his conversation with Cindy, Miles was in no mood for abstract philosophy. The silver bell sat on the table between them, and Miles had to suppress a strong impulse to toss it into the river. Not the river of life, either. The old woman must have read his thought, because she picked up the bell and set it down again on her side of the table, well out of his reach. "My late husband," Mrs. Whiting began, then stopped. "Did you ever meet him?" "I don't think so." Miles had been away at college when C.B. Whiting had put a bullet in his brain. In this very gazebo, they said. In fact, whenever he met Mrs. Whiting out here, he made a conscious effort not to look too closely for evidence of the gunshot, a small piece of missing latticework, perhaps, or a bullet-splintered rafter. The old woman studied him for a moment, then shrugged. The ease with which she summoned the memory of a man who'd taken his own life, her husband, for God's sake, always amazed him. It was almost as if she expected other people to be made uncomfortable by such recollections of him, not herself. "You probably did without knowing it. He wasn't the sort of man you'd notice unless you knew he had money." "You noticed him," Miles couldn't help pointing out. "True," she chuckled, "and I just explained why. At any rate, he was no more foolish than most men, I suppose, and you'll never guess what he was up to when I met him. He was actually engaged in altering the flow of this very river, spent a small fortune dynamiting channels and building guide walls and levees upstream, not to mention bribing state officials to allow all of this, simply so trash wouldn't collect along our bank. He died imagining he'd succeeded, too. So how's that for folly?" Miles shrugged, far too miffed with the old woman to pretend much interest in the arrogance of the rich. "But now the river's gone back to doing what it wants, and what it wants is to wash up dead animals and all manner of trash on my nice lawn. That's the lovely odor you noticed when you sat down, which is my point. Lives are rivers, We imagine we can direct their paths, though in the end there's but one destination, and we end up being true to ourselves only because we have no choice. People speak of selfishness, but that's another folly, because, of course, there's no such thing. It's a point I could never make your dear mother comprehend. In her own way, she was like my late husband, except it was always human rivers she was trying to redirect. Miles pretended to examine the scratch Timmy had given him on the back of his hand, a ragged tear that had already puffed up along its length, stinging and itching at the same time. It was probably true that Grace Roby had been foolish enough to believe she could change lives. No doubt she'd married Max with this very idea in mind. There was a difference, though. Her purpose was never to change the course of rivers so the garbage wouldn't wash up on her shores. He considered making this distinction to Mrs. Whiting and immediately thought better of it. "You might have mentioned that Cindy was home," he said. "She wanted to surprise you," the old woman said, bending down to pick up something underneath the round table. To Miles's astonishment, it was Timmy the cat. There were times when he suspected there must be two of the little beasts, since she never seemed to pass from one place to another but simply materialized in the middle of things. The screen door, Miles noted, was still shut. How had she gotten out, then crossed the wide expanse of manicured lawn without his noticing? Miles wiped away the blood with his handkerchief, eyeing Timmy warily, and wondering, as he always did, why anyone would keep such a homicidal animal when there was a perfectly good river right out their back door. Timmy's previous owner had had the right idea. At the moment, however, Timmy looked anything but homicidal. She burrowed under her mistress's bosom and began to purr loudly, studying Miles with feline indifference, her eyelids closing slowly as if heavy with sleep, then opening again to reveal urine-yellow orbs. "Which of them scratched you, my daughter or this one?" "I wish to God you'd put her down," he said, having offered on numerous occasions to attend to the task himself. "And I don't mean on the ground, either." "Dear boy," the old woman smiled, "when you're upset, you're careless with your pronouns. I assume you're referring to the cat. Do correct me if I'm mistaken." Miles sighed. "I'm afraid I've upset her. I didn't mean to." "Poor Miles," Mrs. Whiting said. "You have an overdeveloped sense of responsibility. Surely you know you're not responsible for my daughter's sad life. You were just a little boy when she had her accident." In fact, that terrible event was one of his earliest and most vivid memories. Miles hadn't seen the child run over, but people had talked about the accident for weeks, and the images lingered much longer in his horrified mind. The car had struck and then dragged the little girl, crushing both of her legs and fracturing her pelvis. She'd sustained serious head trauma as well, slipping into a coma shortly after she was hospitalized, and for several weeks it had appeared that she would surely die. The authorities conducted a frantic and prolonged search for the bright green Pontiac that had been reported speeding away from the scene. Miles still remembered how everyone in Empire Falls who owned a Pontiac had fallen under suspicion. At first it was assumed that the driver was probably local, because the accident took place on the Whiting side of the Iron Bridge. Back then, there hadn't been much on that side of the river except the Whiting property and the country club. Jimmy Minty's father had owned a beat-up old red Pontiac at the time, and he always parked it in the shared driveway between his house and the Robys, a reminder that he owned a car and they did not, at least most of the time. Max was always buying cars, but he seldom made payments on them, so they were invariably repossessed. When Miles was a boy, he figured it was these repossessions that caused his father to disappear. And when he asked his mother if Max had been repossessed along with the car, the remark had delighted her and made him feel foolish for having made a joke he couldn't understand. From his bedroom window on the second floor, Miles had looked down at the Minty's red Pontiac, certain, despite the fact that it was the wrong color, that it must be the car that had run over the Whiting girl. Mr. Minty was a big man with a terrible temper, and he seemed to Miles just the sort to run over a little rich girl. He was forever appearing at their back door, though never when Max was home, and offering meat from his freezer. Grace, who usually invited people in, never did with Mr. Minty, who had a way of looking his mother over that made Miles uncomfortable. In fact, Grace always made sure the screen door was locked when she saw him coming. And here was the murderous vehicle right outside, probably waiting for Miles to cross carelessly behind it. But even as a boy, he understood instinctively that his being run over wouldn't cause nearly the sensation that Cindy Whiting's accident had. And he was right. The fact that it was the Whiting girl had, of course, captured the imagination of everyone in Dexter County. That such a tragedy should visit a family historically shielded from misfortune had occasioned a wave of philosophizing, especially in the mill workers' neighborhoods. It just went to prove, people said, that God didn't play favorites. He didn't love the rich more than the poor, not really, and it took something like this to demonstrate this oft-doubted truth. Grace had not been sympathetic to such talk, which surprised Miles, because she'd always told him that God's hand could be seen in all things. But she was adamant that it wasn't God behind the wheel of that Pontiac, which caused Miles to wonder if she was taking God's side in hopes that when he next decided to loose a little more misfortune upon the world, he'd remember who his faithful were. If Mrs. Whiting was right, and Miles's feeling of responsibility for Cindy was exaggerated, he came by it rightly. For in retrospect, it seemed to him that his mother had been genuinely unhinged by the accident, as if it had somehow confirmed what she'd always feared, that the world was teeming with dangers. She was forever trying to use the accident to frighten Miles out of his tree climbing, describing what would happen if he fell, and asking if he wanted to be crippled for the rest of his life, like little Cindy Whiting. Of course, this argument made less than perfect sense to Miles, who saw being up in a tree as reducing his chances of being run over by a car. But Grace was determined and inflexible, because she and Mrs. Whiting had given birth on the same day, in the same hospital. In his mother's imagination, he and Cindy Whiting had become psychic twins, or so he supposed. Right from the start, Grace had sent the little Whiting girl birthday and Christmas cards, though Mrs. Whiting, to Miles's knowledge, never reciprocated. After the accident, Grace made sure that he understood they had a special duty toward the crippled child. If Miles had a birthday party, Cindy Whiting had to be invited. If they saw her in town with her mother, Miles was always instructed to go over and say hello. Cindy Whiting, she reminded him over and over, was a brave little girl who'd endured one operation after another. A terrible thing had happened to her, and that meant other people had an obligation to make nice things happen. This, Grace Robey believed, was a person's duty on earth, God's plan, spelled out in the Bible, to make life a little more fair. Was for us to feed the hungry, to give warm clothing to those who were cold, and drink to those who were thirsty. Max, on his way out of the door to his favorite tavern, always seconded this one. And most important, it was our duty to give love to those who needed our affection. Max was usually gone by the time his wife got around to the most important point. In Grace's opinion, it was love that people needed most, more than food and shelter and warmth. And the best part was that love didn't cost anything. Even poor people could afford to make a gift of it to the rich. Though his mother never actually told him so, Miles suspected that something, or maybe a cluster of things, had happened at the hospital when she and Francine Whiting were delivering their babies, something that caused his mother to forge her belief in the psychic link between the newborns. Her logic was not so hard to reconstruct. Two children born within hours of each other into such different circumstances, one rich, the other poor. No doubt the hospital staff would have made clear to Grace in 100 small ways which was the important baby, and such a quiet and thoughtful woman couldn't have failed to contemplate the very different destinies in store for her child and the child of a woman whose last name was Whiting, even if not so long ago it had been Robidoux. She might even have considered the unfairness of it all, and wondered if babies were ever mistakenly switched in their bassinets, fate thwarted by incompetence. Not that such a switch was likely when one child was a boy, the other a girl, but still. How could a woman in Grace's position not ponder such questions? Yet this explanation had never felt terribly compelling to Miles. For one thing, if memory served, even before Cindy Whiting's accident, Grace seemed to consider her own infant the lucky one, the one God had blessed. Why? Miles had no idea. He didn't know if his mother had been acquainted with Francine Robideau before she married the richest man in central Maine, but he doubted it, which meant that Grace had no prior reason to suspect that Francine would make a poor mother. Any knowledge she had about the other woman would have sprung from their acquaintance at the hospital. Still, Grace had been a close and intuitive observer, and perhaps she'd simply seen the baby girl struggling at her mother's meager breast and thus projected for her a hungry future. Whatever her reasons, Grace had always pointed the little Whiting girl out as someone important, someone for him to be especially kind to. The accident had not occasioned the connection, but merely amplified it. So when the senior prom rolled around and Cindy Whiting didn't have a date, it fell to Miles to invite her. Though by then his heart had been lost to a pretty girl named Charlene Gardner, who was 3 years older than he and a waitress at the Empire Grill, where Miles had an after-school job bussing dishes and washing pots, a girl who seemed to understand how devoted he was to her, who was unfailingly kind and affectionate, and never allowed her many boyfriends to joke about him too harshly in his hearing, who sometimes even appeared to take his affection seriously. Unfortunately, according to Grace, Miles had no duty to love the Gardner girl. True, Charlene was about as pretty as girls got in Empire Falls, Grace conceded. Still, she was careful to explain something she said he was too young to comprehend just then, though one day he would.
"Charlene Gardner isn't really a girl," she said, causing Miles's jaw to drop. "I know she's not that much older, but she's already a woman, and you're still a boy."
Grace might have been right about the latter, but she'd been dead wrong about his not understanding that Charlene was a woman. That was what he liked best about her, and his favorite fantasies concerned the various ways in which she might make him a man. Whereas Cindy Whiting, he suspected, would never make him anything but miserable, a prediction that had been borne out over the next 30 years, right up to the present moment. When Timmy the cat raised her head, Mrs. Whiting obliged by scratching her neck.
"I suppose I should put you down," she allowed. "You're a truly hateful little beast. Still, one does have to admire the intensity of your feelings."
"I don't," Miles said. "She either scratches or bites me every time I come here."
"Oh, it's not just you, dear boy. She treats everyone who isn't family with the most exquisite malice. She dug a furrow the length of the mayor's forearm just last week, didn't you, sweetheart?"
"You should hold a raffle," Miles suggested. $10 a shot, and the winner gets to beat her to death with a baseball bat. We could use the proceeds to help finish off the new wing of the hospital." The old woman clapped her hands in delight.
"I don't know why I'm always so surprised to be reminded of your sense of humor, dear boy."
"Did I say something funny?" Miles inquired.
"You see, there it is again. You must get it from that reprobate father of yours. He called me again when you were gone, by the way. I had to threaten him with the police."
"I'll speak to him."
"Does he have any clue what a funny little man he is?"
"I don't think so. A lot of it's lost on me, actually."
"And your mother, as well, dear woman. Poor Grace was not blessed with a sense of life's grand folly."
At this, Timmy shook her head, piston fashion, and studied her mistress in a way that suggested she was following this conversation with interest.
"Actually, my mother loved to laugh."
Miles hated talking about his mother with Mrs. Whiting almost as much as with Jimmy Minty. "Life may be a grand folly, as you say, but it's harder to appreciate the joke when you're always the butt of it."
"Yes, I am aware that life is hard for some people," Mrs. Whiting conceded, as if she'd heard this sentiment expressed somewhere before and supposed it might be true. "Still, I've always believed that people largely make their own luck, and you needn't smile at that, Miles Roby." For once, she sounded almost sincere. You think I married my luck, but that conclusion is both unkind and unthoughtful, and it does you no credit. There's a world of skill and timing involved in marrying the right person, especially when the girl in question comes from the Robidoux Blight. By way of Bowdoin College, Miles felt compelled to add, since being reminded of this was likely to annoy her. People who imagine themselves to be self-made seldom enjoy examining the process of manufacture in detail.
Dear me, yes, Mrs. Whiting agreed, missing only half a beat. Let us not forget Bowdoin and the liberating effects of higher education. Though it doesn't liberate everyone, does it?
Meaning himself, Miles understood. One of Mrs. Whiting's great skills was rolling with the punches. Whenever she absorbed a blow, she came back out swinging. Miles settled in, prepared for his drubbing.
Still, a wise marriage is a rare thing, don't you think? She asked.
Most people make a complete hash of it. They marry the wrong people for all the wrong reasons. For reasons so absurd they can't even remember what they were a few short months after they've pledged themselves forever. To the unhappily married, what it was that possessed them remains a lifelong mystery, though to observers their reasons are often painfully obvious. For instance, I'd wager you have no idea why you married.
Miles nodded. You mean you'd bet if you could find somebody to bet with?
So you admit you have no idea, she cried. Lovely! Now then, shall I tell you?
No, thanks.
Come, come, dear boy. Aren't you the least little bit interested?
In truth, he was, or would have been, had he believed Mrs. Whiting possessed any genuine insight. What she wanted to share with him, he felt sure, was her mean-spiritedness.
So why did I marry Mrs. Whiting?
Oh, good, she said. I thought for a moment there you were going to be a party pooper.
You married out of fear, dear boy.
Timmy again shook her head violently, as if to suggest she wasn't sure she'd heard right.
Shall I go on?
I thought fear was the reason men didn't get married.
Don't be absurd. Just because people are forever saying silly things, that doesn't make them true.
So what was I afraid of? Miles heard himself ask.
You really don't know?
She smiled. Timmy yawned widely, as if to suggest that even she could answer this one.
Oh, my, it's true. You don't, do you?
Well, then, this gives us the opportunity to test the old adage that the truth will set you free. I've never quite believed it myself, but...
Mrs. Whiting?
She leaned toward him and lowered her voice conspiratorially.
You married, dear boy, to escape an even worse fate. I suspect you're ashamed of this, but really you shouldn't be. You may not know this about yourself, but what I'm about to reveal to you is quite true, I assure you. By nature, you instinctively seek out the middle road, midway between dangerous passion and soul-destroying indifference. Your whole adult life has been a study in deft navigation, and I don't mind telling you, I've long admired the way you've charted your course. You chastise yourself, and don't pretend you don't, because I won't believe you for making a poor marriage, but that's foolishness. You merely saved yourself, and self-preservation is the design feature we all have in common. Bravo, is what I say.
Saved myself from what, Mrs. Whiting?
Oh, surely you suspect, given so immediate a reminder. Think, dear boy, remember. You willingly entered a bad marriage to save yourself from a worse one. You feared that if you didn't marry soon, you'd find yourself at the altar with my daughter, because you were certain those were your mother's wishes. You had enough of your father in you to cut yourself the best deal you could that didn't involve the more elegant solution of simply running away. The Greyhound Terminal was still operating in Empire Falls 20 years ago, but that would never have been an option for Grace Roby's son. All those catechism classes convinced you that no one gets away scot-free. So you attained that safe middle ground. Maybe you couldn't have what you wanted most, which was that girl with the knockers who still works for you at the restaurant, am I right? But you were clever enough to avoid what you feared most, which was a poor crippled young woman who was suicidally in love with you and whose pitiful devotion would have made your life one long, hellish exercise in moral virtue. Mrs. Whiting was brushing her lap off now, Timmy apparently having jumped down at some point, though Miles didn't recall seeing her do it. So, here you are, moping about, doing your duty in daily penance instead of celebrating your achievement, as any sensible person would. And I do wish you'd say something instead of just sitting there looking gut-shot. Believe it or not, it was not my intention to hurt your feelings. What was your intention? To give you a badly needed heads-up, dear boy. To point out that despite your considerable skill, you're back in the soup. You're about to become a bachelor again, are you not? Surely you don't imagine that this situation with my daughter's return to beautiful Empire Falls are entirely coincidental. No, now that he thought of it, he didn't. To be frank, I'm more than a little curious to see how you'll handle this business the second time around. Curious. She looked at him over the rim of her glasses. Oh, please, spare me that tone of moral superiority. That you get from your mother. Frankly, it was the one tiresome, disagreeable trait in an otherwise charming woman. She couldn't bring herself to be openly critical, but she was forever using that very same tone. No doubt she shared your mistaken opinion that my intellect is cold and uncaring, whereas in fact it is simply lively. A lively intellect, so much admired in a man, is seldom tolerated in a woman. Or am I mistaken? Am I mistaken, or is this your daughter we're talking about? Actually, I thought we were speaking about you. I feel my daughter's plight, dear boy, and have done so all her life. Believe this or not, as you choose. But forgive me for speaking the truth here and pointing out that her predicament, though poignant, is not, compared to your own, terribly interesting. Fate intervened at an early age, and since her accident, my daughter's life has been largely determined by forces beyond her understanding and control. Pity and fear, if I recall correctly, are the appropriate emotional and moral responses. But once fate takes the reins and free will is thrown from the saddle, there's really little to be said, is there? You, on the other hand, are an actor, however reluctant, on life's stage. Not everyone gets to choose, as you once did. And now you get to choose again. Don't tell me you don't find that extraordinary. I'm not saying I envy you, but I am curious. Will you choose the same or differently? Most of your original options remain open. You could marry again, for instance, that girl with the knockers. After all, there's that tiny voice in your head, the one you always turn a deaf ear to, which is forever asking, "Don't I deserve a little happiness? Haven't I been a good boy long enough?" But then there's the other voice, the one your mother was so instrumental in forming, that accuses you of selfishness, of not thinking of others. Like poor, crippled Cindy Whiting, doesn't she deserve a little happiness? And this time around, you might just listen to that voice, because it's the one that feels moral. Or would, if it didn't trail those nagging considerations of self-interest. Because, of course, the money that would accompany such a marriage would be nice, and you're tired of straining to make ends meet. Who wouldn't be? If you started feeling too guilty, you certainly could tell yourself you were doing it for your daughter, who'll soon be ready to go off to college. And isn't she the one who really matters? Oh, dear me, it is complicated. No surprise that people are always trying to simplify life. What's that question our evangelical brethren are always asking? What would Jesus do? What indeed? The breeze shifted then, and Miles caught another rancid whiff off the river. Whether from the near bank or from the Empire Falls side, he couldn't tell. Something tells me you have some advice for me. She sighed. I fear not, dear boy. Beyond clarifying your dilemma, I'm afraid I can offer very little indeed. Alas, there's only one thing I'm quite sure of. And that is? My daughter may have suggested to you that her doctors believe her to be well. Miles nodded. Mrs. Whiting, eyebrows arched, shook her head.
It was nearly 3 PM before Miles drove back across the Iron Bridge into Empire Falls. The day had gone gray by the time he pulled in behind the rectum, the clouds framing the accusing steeple now heavy with rain. Which was not the worst of it. Seated on the porch steps, in apparently pleasant conversation, sat the old priest, Father Tom, and Max Roby, who looked up and grinned when his son switched off the Jetta's ignition. After a few minutes, Miles having made no move to get out of the car, Max shuffled over and motioned for him to roll down the passenger side window. Evidently, Max felt safer with the entire width of the car between them.
"What are you doing here, Dad?" Miles said, rubbing his temples with his fingertips.
"Waiting on you."
"What for?"
"I've been waiting on you for 2 hours.
Old Father Tom was still sitting where Max had left him, but he now fixed Miles with his baleful gaze. Though the old man's lips were moving, he was too far away for Miles to guess whether any of the words they were forming might be peckerhead.
"Let's go to work," Max suggested.
"It's about to rain," Miles said, pointing at the sky.
"Maybe not," Max said.
"It's going to rain," Miles assured him.
"You should have come earlier," Max said. "The sun was out."
"I know."
"You don't need to pay me for the 2 hours I was waiting."
"I don't have to pay you for anything."
Max considered the unfairness of this, then stared down at the Jetta.
"What happened to your car?"
"None of your business," Miles told him, preferring not to explain. When he'd walked up to the Jetta in the drive outside the Whiting house, he saw a darting movement and suddenly remembered that he left the passenger side window partway down. The car's interior was now full of tiny floating particles of foam from the shredded passenger seat.
"Don't get mad at me," Max said. "I didn't do it."
"I know that."
"I didn't make those clouds either. I didn't do anything. I'm just an old man."
Miles studied his father, whose stubble had a strange orange tint. "Your beard's full of food. Cheetos?"
"So what?"
He had a point, and Mrs. Whiting, Miles sadly reflected, was probably right. People were just themselves, their efforts to be otherwise notwithstanding. Max was just programmed to be Max, to have food in his beard. Looked at from another angle, it probably was admirable that his father never battled his own nature, never expected more of himself than experience had taught him was wise, thereby avoiding disappointment and self-recrimination. It was a fine, sensible way to live, really, much more sensible than Miles's manner as he went about his business, disappointed by his failure to scramble up ladders, blaming himself for his wife's infidelity, perversely maneuvering himself into situations that guaranteed aggravation, if not outright distress. Maybe, as the old lady had suggested, it was all that catechism, its rote insistence on subordinating our will to God's, so many of these lessons administered by the now senile priest who was seated a few yards away and giving him the evil eye. What in the world could these old goats have been discussing? Miles wondered. "Mrs. Whiting says you called her again," Miles said. Max shrugged.
"So what?"
"You said you wouldn't."
"No, I didn't,"
he said, with breathtaking dishonesty. Max firmly believed there was a brief statute of limitations on all promises.
"Her and I are related, you know. The Robys and the Robidoughs, same family."
"You don't know that," Miles said. "You just wish it. Besides which, it doesn't give you any right to call her up late at night begging for money."
"She never answers during the day," Max explained. "She lets her machine pick up."
"People like you are the reason other people get answering machines to begin with," Miles told him. "In fact, people like you are driving a lot of modern technology."
"All I wanted was enough money to get down to the Keys. If you'd cough it up, I wouldn't have to ask her. You're a closer relative than she is, you know."
"She says if you call again, she'll sick the cops on you." Max nodded thoughtfully.
"They'll probably send that Jimmy Minty. My God, he was a stupid kid."
"Not as stupid as yours," Miles would have liked to confess. Leaning over, he rolled up the window.
effectively concluding the conversation, and got out. At least outside, the air wasn't drifting with foam particles. Miles walked around and opened the passenger side door to study the shredded seat, then wisely turned and walked away from the whole mess. After all, the destroyed cushion wasn't the worst of it, because leaving the Whiting house, he'd done something so perverse that even now, 15 minutes later, it nearly took his breath away. What, he wondered, had he been thinking? What he'd done was stop back in the house on his way out and invite Cindy Whiting to accompany him to next weekend's high school football game. Homecoming it was. Dear God, he thought now, staring up at St. Cat's flaking steeple. Why didn't he just climb the ladder all the way to the top, step off the son of a bitch, and be done with it? The truth was, Mrs. Whiting's cynical assessment of his character had rattled him. Maybe the old woman didn't know everything about him, but she knew enough, which made him want to do something to prove her wrong, not just about human nature, but about his nature. He'd wanted to demonstrate that it was possible to act unselfishly, thereby validating his mother's belief in the necessity of sacrifice. Except he now suspected that by asking Cindy out on what she'd no doubt consider a date, he'd prove the very point he hoped to challenge, the middle road. He'd permitted guilt to maneuver him into offering a weak, hypocritical gesture he was pathetically unprepared to follow through with. 20 years ago, at his mother's request, he'd asked Cindy to the prom, and now he'd done almost the same identical thing again. And he could imagine Mrs. Whiting sitting across the river in the gazebo and having a good chuckle at his expense. Once again, she'd played him like a fiddle. And the subject of the beer and wine license, which he'd promised his brother he would raise, had never come up. Chapter 10. 3 weeks into the fall semester, Tick looks up when the cafeteria door opens and the principal, Mr. Meyer, enters with the virtually comatose John Voss in tow. Dressed as usual in a too-large black T-shirt with a stretched-out neck, thrift store polyester golf slacks, and tennis shoes with broken laces, the boy is carrying before him with both hands a lumpy, crumpled paper bag from which Tick deduces that she's to have a luncheon companion. If companion is the right word for it, for a boy Tick has never heard speak. Had Justin not featured John Voss in his constant heckling of Candace, Tick wouldn't even know what to call him. The guys on the football team, who take special glee in tormenting him, just call him Dickhead. After materializing in their midst, 2 years ago, John Voss has remained a mystery. Tick has no idea where he lives, why he's silent, why he dresses as he does, why he doesn't respond to external stimuli. Obviously, he doesn't have a single friend, which makes him unique, since the school's other pathetic social outcasts have formed a loose society. Actually, the person John Voss most resembles, now that Tick thinks about it, is Tick, at least now that she's no longer part of Zach Minty's crowd. If it weren't for Candace pumping her for information during art class, Tick herself would probably go all day without speaking a word to anyone. For all she knows, in the eyes of the other kids at school, she might look as pathetic as this silent boy now standing before her. At the moment, he's staring at the floor, awaiting a command from Mr. Meyer, who, lacking one, studies the boy for a moment as you would a uniformed guard at a wax museum, waiting for him to move so you can be sure he isn't part of the exhibit. Is it possible, Tick wonders, for a boy to possess less natural grace? He looks like he's been taking lessons in the art of human movement from a Disney World robot. When Mr. Meyer tells him to take a seat anywhere he wants, he shuffles to the other side of the cafeteria, sits down, and stares at his brown paper bag for an exaggerated beat before opening it and peering inside. Whatever is inside does not immediately motivate him to further action. Mr. Meyer continues to watch for a minute, looking especially clueless even for a high school principal.
To Tick, he resembles a soldier who's been parachuted into the middle of a battlefield and instructed to make weapons out of whatever materials are at hand. When he motions for her to join him outside in the hall, she reluctantly complies.
"I found someone to have lunch with you," Mr. Meyer reports, once the door is safely shut between them.
Tick can't help but stare at him. The fundamental dishonesty of adults never fails to amaze her. Their assumption that you'll believe whatever they say just because they're grown-ups and you're a kid. As if the history of adults' dealings with adolescents were one long, unbroken continuum of truth-telling. As if no kid was ever given a reason to distrust anyone over the age of 25. In this instance, Mr. Meyer would apparently have Tick believe that in the 2 weeks since allowing this solitary lunch privilege, he's been thinking of nothing except finding her a companion. Whereas Tick doubts that she's crossed his mind until provoked by the larger problem of what to do with this wretched boy, who by virtue of being friendless, voiceless, and graceless, has become the target of every lunchroom bully who considers it fine sport to hit him in the back of the head with empty milk containers, broken pencils, thumb-shot rubber bands, and any other handy missile, launching these objects from all the way across the cafeteria for maximum impact. Tick's strategy for dealing with lying adults is to say nothing and watch the lies swell and constrict in their throats. When this happens, the lie takes on a physical life of its own and must be either expelled or swallowed. Most adults prefer to expel untruths with little burp-like coughs behind their hands, while others chuckle or snort or make barking sounds. When Mr. Meyer's Adam's apple bobs once, Tick sees that he's a swallower, and that this particular lie has gone south down his esophagus and into his stomach. According to her father, who's an old friend of Mr. Meyer's, the man suffers from bleeding ulcers. Tick can see why. She imagines all the lies a man in his position would have to tell, how they must just churn away down there in his intestines like chunks of undigestible food awaiting elimination. By their very nature, Tick suspects, lies seek open air. They don't like being confined in dark, cramped places. Still, she likes Mr. Meyer better for being a swallower. Her father, who lies neither often nor well, at least by adult standards, is also a swallower. And she approves that his lies go down so painfully. The snorters, like Mrs. Rodrigue, and the barkers, like Walt Como, are the worst.
"John has the same scheduling difficulty you had because of art class," Mr. Meyer continues, studying her to see how this second lie will play, his Adam's apple bobbing again. John Voss has no such scheduling difficulty, Tick knows. Except for computer studies, at which the boy is reportedly brilliant, he's in all low-track classes, and art fits this program like a glove. When Tick remains silent, Mr. Meyer breaks into a nervous sweat. What is this, 2 comatose kids? If coming to the aid of floundering liars weren't against Tick's religion, she'd be tempted to toss him a rope. She hasn't forgotten his kindness the afternoon that Candace sliced her thumb open with the X-Acto knife, and she hasn't forgotten that she repaid his kindness and concern with duplicity by slipping the knife into her backpack, where it has remained ever since. "Actually, I have a favor to ask you, Christina," Mr. Meyer continues, his Adam's apple stationary now, so this part of it must be true. He nods at the door. "John Voss is a very unhappy boy, more unhappy than anyone suspects, I fear." He's lowered his voice another notch, perhaps worried that the unhappy boy might find out about his unhappiness and be unhappier still. "There is an element in our school that finds in this unfortunate young man an excellent candidate for ridicule and even worse forms of cruelty." He pauses to study Tick here, hoping maybe she'll contradict him by testifying that no such element exists. About this, he would very much like to be wrong. "We have a good school here," he quickly adds, as if fearful that his criticism has gone too far. "But not everyone..." As his voice trails off, his Adam's apple starts bobbing again, confirming Tick's belief that omissions, too, can be lies, perhaps the most dangerous ones.
What John Voss needs, Mr. Meyer says, placing a hand on her shoulder, is a friend. Tick would not like to, but she takes an involuntary step backward anyway. She doesn't like being touched by adults. The silver fox, who is forever dragging a paw across the top of her head when he passes by, has no idea how badly this gesture makes her want to shower and wash her hair. Mr. Meyer notices the reflex and quickly removes his hand. I don't mean... Tick waits patiently for the man to explain what he doesn't mean. It's not that you should be best pals or anything like that, he says, mopping his glistening forehead with a cloth handkerchief. I'm just thinking how nice it would be for that boy to know there's somebody his own age who doesn't... Consider him a maggot, Tick thinks, since completing the sentence isn't all that hard. She completes it a few other ways, too, substituting snail, rodent, cockroach, lizard, toad for maggot, while Mr. Meyer continues to wrestle mightily with the dilemma of teen cruelty. You may have heard that some boys assaulted him in the cafeteria yesterday, he says, abandoning completely his lie about having at long last found Tick a suitable lunch companion. When Tick nods, almost imperceptibly, he continues. This is the second such incident in recent... Now even common words used to denote time, days, weeks, months, what, seem to have deserted him. Mr. Meyer looks hopefully at Tick, as if she may be able to supply the needed information. Or perhaps he is awaiting her promise that should he entrust the unfortunate John Voss to her company, she herself will be able to withstand the apparently universal impulse to beat the boy up. Or else, just possibly, the principal is aware how big a favor it is that he's asking. He's been trying to pretend it's a small, good thing, but they both know better. He's asking someone on one of the lowest rungs of the high school's social ladder, a person nearly as friendless as the boy she's to befriend, to descend to the very bottom of the ladder itself, into the damp darkness where those dwell who have no hope or recourse, but to wait patiently for their eventual rescue in the form of graduation, if applicable, college, ditto, a job, in Empire Falls, marriage, implausible, or death, finally. Maybe you could elicit the help of one or two of your friends, Mr. Meyer suggests, as if it suddenly occurred to him that this job is too big for a skinny, already unpopular kid. Maybe the girl from Mrs. Rodrigue's art class, the one who cut herself. Tick can't help but smile at this, recalling Candace's horror at being jokingly linked with John Voss. Candace? Yes, Candace, Mr. Meyer agrees quickly, thrilled that Tick should recognize the very girl he is referring to, or perhaps simply relieved that Tick has at last uttered a sound in his presence. Or whoever, he adds just as quickly, so as not to seem like he's telling her how to do her job. Okay, I'll try, Tick hears herself promise, feeling her heart plummet. Nor does it cheer her to see the weight of moral responsibility lifting off Mr. Meyer's thick, round shoulders and descending onto her own slender, bony ones. The man seems to stand straighter, having set this responsibility down, and suddenly looks as if he'd like to skip down the corridor, whistling all the way. But then his face clouds over again, and Tick suspects that she's misjudged him. The Minty boy, he begins. Zack, Tick says. There's only one Minty boy. Is he a friend of yours? He used to be. Mr. Meyer nods thoughtfully, then nods toward the cafeteria. That boy is suffering. I don't mean to say that Zachary Minty participates directly, but I don't think any of this could happen without his encouragement. But perhaps I'm being unfair to him. I wouldn't worry about being unfair to Zack. Tick regrets these words as soon as they're out, perceiving that they amount to an implied alliance, or worse, a shared worldview between herself and the principal. She senses, too, that going into battle with Mr. Meyer at her side would be a lot like going into battle alone. Clearly, though, her remark has restored the man's happiness. How are you and Doris getting along these days? He asks, using Mrs. Rodrigue's Christian name as the gesture of intimacy that seals their deal.
Great,
Tick says, swallowing hard, since she can see no advantage in telling the truth, that she'd assume the woman were dead. Back inside the cafeteria, Tick decides that the most attractive of her options is to pretend the conversation with Mr. Meyer never took place. For one thing, the principal will quickly forget that he has asked this favor of her, if he hasn't already. He'll likely remember their agreement only if he runs into her in the next day or so, and she's confident of her ability to steer clear of him, given her anonymity in the halls of Empire High. Unless their eyes actually meet, he won't notice her. If their eyes should meet, the worst that can happen is that he will remember, in which case he'll ask what kind of progress she's made. And Tick knows how easily adults are satisfied with vagaries. A shrug of the shoulders and a, "not bad, I guess," will usually do the trick. Almost as attractive as this scenario, which risks little and requires less, is another. She can go over to the boy and say, "So, you want to eat lunch together?" She can make clear from the tone of her voice that she's been put up to this by Mr. Meyer and is merely making good on a promise extracted under duress. The second option has the added advantage of being the truth, assuming that's ever an advantage. The point is the boy will want no part of her charity, and that will be the end of it. After all, he did select a table on the other side of the cafeteria, and if that gesture wasn't clear enough, he chose a chair facing away from her. In all probability, he wants no more to do with her than she does with him. By far, the least attractive possibility is to make an honest effort, and at first, Tick thinks that she won't, that it's simply too much to ask. The only problem is that while John Voss has aimed himself away from her, she, unfortunately, is facing him, and she does not relish the idea of spending the rest of her lunch period staring at the victim's accusing back. Having eaten half the chicken salad sandwich her father made for her at the restaurant that morning, she has no interest in the rest. What she'd planned to do with the last 20 minutes of the period was read another chapter of her Picasso book, which she'd finished last week, and which so inspired her that she'd immediately begun again. She simply marveled at how content the man was to be different, to go his own way, self-reliantly, as Emerson said you should in that essay they'd read back in the first week of English class. It's a pretty neat trick, that, and Tick would like to learn how it's done, though she knows the book doesn't reveal the how of it, at least not on the first reading. Still, just knowing that such self-confidence is possible is reassuring to her, and reading a few pages during lunch would help her make it through the afternoon. But in order to concentrate, she'd have to get up and change seats so that her back would be to John Voss's back. When she gets up from her chair to do precisely this, she's surprised to discover herself shouldering her backpack, picking up her lunch leftovers, and making her way across the cafeteria. At the boys' table, when she sets her backpack down with a thud on one of the plastic chairs, he looks part way up, maybe to chin level, then back at his food. He's eating what looks like tuna fish from a plastic container. Whatever it is, its odor is particularly strong. Tick herself is well on her way to becoming a vegetarian, and most meat and fish smell rancid to her. "I liked your egg," she offered, an awkward opening gambit.
"You don't have to talk to me,"
the boy says quickly and rudely, so rudely, in fact, that Tick considers herself absolved of further moral obligation. Where he gets off offering her an attitude she can't imagine. No wonder he gets the shit kicked out of him every other day. But instead of retreating, she pulls out a plastic chair, then sits and stares until he looks up again, almost but not quite meeting her eye. Already she's made progress, it occurs to her. The boy has actually spoken, which means he's not a mute. "Maybe I want to," she says, quickly swallowing the lie, Meyer fashion, and allowing just a touch of rudeness to edge into her own tone. "Maybe I feel like telling you I liked your egg."
Uh-huh, he responds, shoveling the oily, stringy lunch substance into his mouth, causing Tick to wonder what it would be like to kiss a boy after he'd eaten something so disgusting. He told you to. The boy allows the pronoun to hang there in the air. It's as if, for John Voss at least, Mr. Meyer is still in the cafeteria with them. Spooky. Also, each time the boy glances up, his eyes hesitate for a split second on Tick's sandwich before dropping again to his own ghastly fare. So, how come you dream about eggs? She finally decides to ask.
I don't dream about eggs.
What a dumb thing to dream about, his tone of voice seems to suggest. Each time he speaks, the shock of hearing his voice at all takes her by surprise. It's a perfectly normal, if somewhat angry-sounding voice, and there's nothing so very odd about it except that before now, she's never heard him use it. His voice, Tick concludes, is the one normal thing about this otherwise deeply weird boy. Well, the assignment was to paint your most vivid dream, she reminds him.
I never dream, he says, so I couldn't do the assignment.
Everybody dreams. He meets her eye for the first time now, reminding her of something. She can't quite think what.
You're one person, he says, as if to suggest that's just as well, that he wouldn't have wished her to replicate.
True, she allows. So?
So how does that qualify you to know what everybody in the world does or doesn't do?
Tick, having already had this conversation with her father, feels pretty confident of the intellectual terrain.
It's called an inference, she says.
If she were certain she could speak with such authority in class, she wouldn't be so quiet. I infer that no two snowflakes are alike. I don't have to examine every one.
The boy doesn't miss a beat. That's not a very good example, he says, as if he, too, may have had a similar conversation before. When you say that I must dream because you do, you're inferring that nobody can be different from you, not that everybody must be similar. His eyes fall on her Picasso book. Wasn't he different?
This she'd have to think about.
In degree, she decides, pleased to discover that this is what she actually believes, not just something she's saying to keep from losing an argument. She's even more pleased to see her companion shrug as if it didn't matter.
Tick herself is shrugged enough to know that this is what you do when it does matter. Or more precisely, she infers that one of his shrugs means more or less the same thing as one of hers.
So how come you're thinking about eggs?
He shrugs again, as before. So Tick pays particular attention when he says,
It's just something my mom said once. If chickens had any idea what was in store for them, they'd stay where they were in their eggs.
Ah, a philosophical position.
She was actually frying eggs at the time, the boy continued. I'm not sure she understood that those particular eggs were never going to become chickens. My mom wasn't all that smart. According to Grandma, anyhow.
Tick hesitates, then decides to ask, Is your mother dead?
That's a possibility, he says, as if it were a matter of scientific curiosity only.
Tick tries to puzzle this out. She likes to understand things, hates to admit when she doesn't, especially if she suspects she's missing something obvious. Another leading question just might result in ridicule, however, so she waits until it becomes clear that John Voss has said all he intends to say on this subject.
I don't get it, she finally admits.
You don't get it, he snorts, the contemptuous kind of response that keeps people from even bothering.
Angry now, Tick takes the bit in her teeth and says, No, I don't get it.
Finally, the boy says, My dad left first, then my mom remarried and they left. After that, I came here to live with my grandmother. Now you get it?
He's finished his lunch by now, the smell of it still thick in the air between them. When his eyes pause again on Tick's half-eaten sandwich, she says,
I can't finish this. You can have it if you're still hungry.
I'm full, he says. But he doesn't look even remotely full. So Tick watches his Adam's apple, expecting to see it bob. The boy has a long, thin neck and an Adam's apple that juts out from beneath his pale skin like the edge of something foreign and jagged. Tick can tell from the rash on his neck that he's recently begun to shave and doesn't really have the knack yet. He can handle his upper lip and his chin, but not the less regular topography of his pimply neck, where the hair is tougher and grows at unpredictable angles. There are individual hairs he's apparently been missing for weeks, because they have begun to curl. When the boy's eyes flicker at something over her shoulder, Tick glances at the cafeteria door, where Zach Minty's face is framed, motionless, in one of the small rectangular windows. She nearly flinches, since something about the stillness of the face in the tiny window suggests that it's been there for a long time, observing them. She's just about to tell her companion not to worry, that the cafeteria door is always locked after fifth period, when Zach flings it open and saunters inside. Some people, Tick thinks, should never be entrusted with keys, and Mr. Meyer is one of them. Having unlocked the door to let John in, he's forgotten to lock it back up again. This after lecturing Tick at the beginning of their solitary lunch arrangement that this door must remain closed, that she wasn't to open it for any of her friends. As the door clangs shut, Zach Minty pauses dramatically, as if to give both his former girlfriend and Empire High School's favorite object of derision time to consider the absurdity of imagining that he, of all people, could ever be kept out of any place he wanted into. In no apparent hurry to join them, he wanders over to the bank of vending machines, hitting each button on the soda machine with the heel of his palm and waiting for something to drop. When nothing does, he places a hand on each side of the machine and leans on it, as if the effort of having made so many simple requests and the disappointment of having been refused have been too much for him. He rests his forehead against its smooth surface for a long beat, then begins to rock the whole thing back and forth until it slams into the wall, and there's the sound of breaking glass inside. Letting the machine fall back into place, he waits. Still nothing. Tick watches this entire exhibition with more fascination than fear. Meanwhile, John Voss seems to have slipped back into his coma. When Zach gives up on the machine and comes over, pulling out a chair next to Tick, she digs three quarters out of her pocket and slides them in front of him. Zach hasn't looked at her yet, but is staring at John Voss, as if searching in vain for a reason for this kid's existence. Eventually, he notices the quarters, though he can't seem to compute a reason for them either.
What's this?
I thought you wanted a soda, Tick says.
No,
he replies, fingering one of the coins and walking it across his knuckles. He once tried to teach Tick this trick, and she knows how proud it makes him. Sitting so close, it's clear that he's grown a couple inches over the summer, but more than that, he's bulked up, causing Tick to wonder if he's on steroids. He's definitely dumb enough, but last spring he swore to her he wouldn't, though their breaking up might have absolved him of this promise. He's still good-looking, though, she has to admit. Good-looking enough to make her wonder, as she did all last year, what he wants with her. He could have a really cool girlfriend if he wanted one. Candace isn't the only one who considers him a major stud. I didn't want a soda, he explains. What I wanted, the quarter continues to dance over his knuckles, was a free soda. And with this, the quarter, which had come to rest between his thumb and forefinger, shoots across the table and hits John Voss in the forehead, hard, just above the left eyebrow. The boy barely flinches, though it had to hurt. When Zach reaches for a second quarter, Tick sweeps both remaining coins into a side pocket of her backpack, where she hears them click against the X-Acto knife she keeps meaning to slip back into the supply cupboard in art class the next chance she gets. So, Zach says, who's this? Your new boyfriend?
No,
Tick says, maybe just a little too quickly,
since Zack is quick to smirk. We were just talking, and you're not supposed to be in here. Zack shrugs and goes back to staring at John Voss. A red spot has appeared where the quarter struck the boy's forehead, and Zack may be wondering, as Tick is, how he can keep from rubbing it. The door wasn't locked, Zack says, and I have a hall pass. He shows her the pass, signed by Mrs. Rodrigue, which in itself is a minor mystery, since he doesn't have a class with her. But then, Zack always has whatever is required. It's one of the more amazing things about him, actually, and Tick is surprised to have forgotten this over the summer. Last year, whenever they went to a movie, he'd have two tickets without having to go to the box office. If one of his friends showed up unexpectedly, he'd produce a third ticket, or a fourth, always secretive about how such things came to him. He'd just smile under direct questioning. He apparently liked to foster the impression that people who were loyal to him would be taken care of. Sliding the pass back into his pocket, he turns to the boy. "Why don't you go away?" he suggests. John Voss treats this as one of the best ideas he's heard in ages, practically jumping to his feet and gathering his things. "My old girlfriend is going to explain why she doesn't like me anymore." The strangest part of this statement is that it appears heartfelt. Zack's point, if she understands him correctly, is that big, stupid, cruel people have feelings too, and she's hurt his. Tick watches the boy walk to the far corner of the cafeteria and sit down with his back to them. She hadn't expected much in chivalry from this kid, but she's still surprised by such unapologetic cowardice. He's apparently come to accept humiliation as his lot in life, perhaps even made it his friend. "Billy Wolf sprained his ankle in practice," Zack says. "That means I'm starting outside linebacker this weekend. You going to the game?" "I don't know," Tick says. The stench of the boy's food has departed with him, mostly, though the plastic container is still there on the table, its lid sealed shut. The fishy smell has been overpowered by Zack's cologne, and Tick notices that during the summer, he too has taken to shaving daily. Either his stubble is less resistant, or else he's mastered the technique that has eluded John Voss. "The gang's going to hang out afterward," he says. "You want to come?" Tick wishes she didn't, but the truth is, she does. Only 3 weeks into the fall semester and she's already tired of being friendless. She misses her friends, if that's what they really are, or at least being part of something. Maybe someday she'll be self-contained like Picasso, but not yet. After meeting Donnie on Martha's Vineyard, she vowed she'd never fall back in with Zack Minty because it wasn't worth it, and she's no fool. She knows it won't be long before he'll start belittling her again, undermining her slender confidence, making fun of the things she cares about, saying Picasso was a fag. Worse, he'll be trying to make her jealous by flirting with prettier girls. Tick understands herself well enough to know she's prone to jealousy. She doesn't like this about herself, and would change it if she could, but she doesn't know how.